From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is the Brian McClain Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, what's up and welcome to the show. Good morning. We're live here from Central Texas on today's News Talk. How's everybody doing out there? Hope you're having a great day. Hope everybody enjoyed the Patrick Henningsen show leading into the Brian McClain show. Great talk with Freddie Ponton there from 21stCenturyWire.com. Right here on TNTRadio.live. Check us out on the web, of course. Sounds like the shop is up. That's exciting. Very excited to see the shop up. Thank you, TNT. Wow, TNT just kicks ass. Just every day I sit down and it's like, wow, new bits, new news pieces, new pieces of the website. It's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Congratulations, TNT. Looking forward to sporting some TNT gear. Okay, today we're going to be joined by Bob Ziedman in the third hour of the show, and we'll be talking about his latest novel, Animal Lab, which is meant to be a modern sequel to George Orwell's Animal Farm. In the second hour, we're going to have Tristan Haggard joining me to discuss his work as a health advocate, and we're going to look at the state of food, the state of health in the West, and talk about potential upcoming food supply issues. And in this first hour, I've got Gregory Deal, author of Everyone is an Entrepreneur. He's waiting in the wings. He'll be joining us shortly here. Let's see, quick headline. Paramedics did CPR on Coolio for 45 minutes before he was pronounced dead. I'm sure most of you have heard by now, a popular rapper from back in the day, Coolio, has passed away. EMTs spent an hour trying to revive Coolio after he was found laying lifeless on the floor of a friend's LA home on Wednesday. According to TMZ, paramedics rushed to the residence in the late afternoon and after his pal discovered the 59-year-old's body inside a bathroom. And rescue crews spent 45 minutes performing CPR on the gangster's paradise hitmaker before he was pronounced dead. Coolio, whose legal name was artist Leon Ivy Jr., is suspected to have passed away from a cardiac arrest. And if you were wondering, no drug paraphernalia was found at the scene. The rapper was based in Las Vegas and had traveled to LA to renew his passport, according to his longtime manager, Jarez Posey. Vaccident, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that's probably a vaccident. Coolio, only 59. It's pretty young for having a cardiac arrest unless you're in terrible health. He did not appear to be in terrible health to me from, you know, I'm no expert. I'm no doctor. I'm no biologist. I can't tell you what a woman is, apparently. But, yeah. All jokes aside, RIP Coolio, and if that was a vaccident, well, add it to the list. Add it to the list. I'm getting pretty sick of this, quite frankly. I've had to watch musicians go through suicide, drug overdoses, all kind of stuff just because they got locked down, because their careers were put on pause. Many of them had tours and albums, world tours, European tours coming up they were excited about. So what did they get to do instead? Well, they got to sit home for 2 years and go through the garbage of COVID lockdowns and then the garbage of vaccine mandates, fake vaccine mandates. These aren't vaccines. We all know that, right? They're not vaccines. They're gene therapy. They're experimental gene therapy. And a lot of people have been injured and killed by them. And who knows? Maybe Coolio is one of them. I think it would help, just a suggestion out there to the mass media cartel, it might help you maintain some of your listeners and viewers if you guys would put the vax status on all of these death reports. I would like to know how many jabs of Pfizer Coolio had. All right. Why is that not in the articles? Just asking for a friend. Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We are on all the major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Gitter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk.
News.
News reported fairly.
They are a reliable source.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, my first guest is an American author and entrepreneur living in Armenia, a country currently under attack by Azerbaijan and being largely ignored by the mainstream media. He's the author of Everyone is an Entrepreneur, a book that examines why entrepreneurship has been so slow to spread in post-Soviet cultures like Armenia. He's also the producer of a book called Sadistic Pleasures, an unsettling series of interviews conducted by an Armenian journalist with prisoners of war who were captured and tortured by the Azeri army during the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh, I probably pronounced that really badly, conflict. His name is Gregory Diehl. Gregory, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining me today.
Hello. You pronounced my last name correctly, which is good. It's Diehl. Sometimes people say Dial or something, but it's pronounced Nagorno-Karabakh, the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic, which is officially considered part of Azerbaijan, but which has been culturally and ethnically Armenian for a long time. It's also called Artsakh sometimes in English. You'll hear that name ascribed to it. So yeah, good to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining the show here on today's News Talk. So you have a pretty, I was reading your article before the show here, sort of about your experience getting into, I mean, obviously you're an entrepreneurial guy. You write about entrepreneurialism. But you moved to Armenia at some point after what sounds like a life of travel. I watched the beginning of your TED talk there, and I noted that you grew up in Southern California, and when you turned 18, you started traveling around the world. So maybe walk us through sort of that origin story there, like how you ended up in Armenia. And you're of Armenian descent too, right?
Yes, my grandmother was Armenian, which makes me one quarter, which definitely goes a certain ways towards making me more accepted by the Armenians, because I can say, well, technically I'm one of you. Which has been an issue in some other places I lived. Like, I own a house in Ecuador, which a great country, love South and Central America in general. But after having spent a few years there, you know, I've come to the realization that no matter how good I am at Spanish, I will never really be seen as an Ecuadorian or a Costa Rican or a Mexican. I'll always be a gringo or whatever the equivalent is in the country I'm in. Which can be an issue if your goal is to really put down roots and become a functioning part of the society, not just be an expat retiree who doesn't interact with the locals. So yeah, I spent basically my entire life since I was 18. I'm 34 now, so that's like 16 years about that I've been traveling around the world. And I moved to Armenia about 3 years ago when I bought an old house in a village, which the village is called Kalavan, and it's about an hour from the border with Azerbaijan. So I don't think I'm in any immediate danger, but there is a remote possibility that they could drone strike or shell or send the infantry to invade my village at any given time. It is a concern we have to be aware of here, but so far, so good.
Excellent. Well, I know there's some strife going on. Let me take a quick read here. And folks, by the way, I'm going to be reading from dreadedcnn.com here. And our Western liberal media is notorious for misrepresenting events in Armenia. But let me just do a let me read this to you, and you can give me your thoughts on it. I want to just read this real quick here because speaking for myself personally, the Armenian story and the conflicts that have happened in the 90s and that are currently brewing right now, like I said, you know, Western media has not done a very good job of keeping us informed. So let me just read this little summary here, and I'll let you weigh in. For anyone who's maybe like me and needs a refresher sort of on the geopolitical situation here, Armenia and Azerbaijan have been fighting for decades over Say it for me again, man.
Nagorno-Karabakh.
Nagorno-Karabakh, thank you. A mountainous enclave recognized as part of Azerbaijan while being home to a large Armenian population. Fighting first erupted toward the end of Soviet rule, and Armenian forces took control of large swaths of territory in and around it in the early 1990s. Azerbaijan, backed by Turkey, largely retook those territories over 6 weeks in 2020. Skirmishes have since erupted periodically despite meetings between Pashinyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev. I'm sure I butchered all those. You can correct me later. Aimed at clinching a comprehensive peace settlement. Domestic unhappiness in Armenia about the 2020 defeat has prompted repeated protests against Pashinyan, who dismissed reports he had signed a deal with Baku. In a Facebook post, he blamed the reports on informational sabotage directed by unfriendly forces. A full-fledged conflict would risk dragging in Russia and Turkey and destabilize an important corridor for oil and gas pipelines, just as war in Ukraine disrupts energy supplies. Armenian Deputy Foreign Minister Paryur Hovashnani said the clashes could escalate into a war, a second major armed conflict in the former Soviet Union, while Russia's military is focused in Ukraine. So there you go. That's the CNN sort of short take on what's going on. What do you think about CNN's summary there? Did they leave anything important out or feed us any lies there?
I'm not a historian, you know, or a journalist, so I'm not going to be making really specific claims about the exact dates that things happened or the historical figures involved. But what I can tell you briefly is that, 2 years ago, Azerbaijan attacked and invaded the disputed region, Nagorno-Karabakh. Of course, at the time, they were claiming, oh, we're just defending ourselves. Nagorno-Karabakh is attacking us, and we're just retaliating, which, of course, then very quickly turned into them capturing all these territories as they were defending themselves, air quotes, right? And at the time, all the Armenians I know were kind of shocked at how little the world cared. And even I was quite surprised because I'm not a social activist, you know, about virtually anything, because I figure people are already going to form their opinions about what's going on. There's already enough information about the various world events. But what surprised me about Azerbaijan attacking was that almost no one I knew outside of the Armenians I know had heard about it. So when I would post things on Facebook like, oh, Azerbaijan just killed a bunch of people today and bombed a church and a hospital and their president is making speeches about their intention to invade Armenia and all these horrible things that would be like, you think would be newsworthy. Virtually none of my American friends or my European friends or anyone I knew except for the Armenians had any idea what I was talking about. And then recently, of course, when Russia invaded Ukraine, everyone is talking about it. Everyone is changing their profile pictures. Everyone is doing TikTok dances in support of Ukraine because it's very obvious that, you know, they're being attacked by a superior world power. And then now the same thing is happening again, 2 years after the war that took place primarily in the disputed region, Nagorno-Karabakh. Now they're attacking Armenia proper. They're shelling villages along the border with apparent intentions of taking over the Syunik, the southern region of Armenia, because that would create a continuous space between Turkey and Azerbaijan and other Turkish countries, which they call pan-Turkism. And again, it seems very few people are talking about this, and very, very few people are stepping up and saying, clearly, we need to defend this poor little country, Armenia, that's being attacked by two much larger, much militarily stronger countries that are clearly trying to invade and take it over. Although there has been some progress that I'm aware of, because recently Nancy Pelosi visited Armenia, and I don't know exactly what she did here or exactly what her plan is, but I know at the very least she made public statements along the lines of saying it's clear that this small democratic country is being attacked by an autocratic, much larger country with intentions of taking it over, right? And this should not be accepted. This should not be allowed. Now, whether the U.S. will do anything after that, or whether anyone else will start paying attention, I don't know. But at the very least, somebody had the balls to call a spade a spade. And that's what we were asking for 2 years ago. Can somebody just, you know, we have plenty of evidence. There are cameras. There are journalists here. Can people just acknowledge what's happening at the very least? Even if you're not going to come and fight for us, at least say that this is what's going on.
Yeah, where's Armenia's chance to get their flag on everybody's social media? Where's their TikTok dances? Yeah, you're reading my mind there, man. You're reading my mind. Yeah, it's absolutely insane, you know. And you know, there was a genocide in Armenia, and a lot of Americans or Westerners, I don't even think remember that or know that. But the Armenian
genocide.
Many haven't
even acknowledged it still.
Yeah, still. And this was during World War One, right?
Yeah, so this was the precursor to the Jewish Holocaust, which, of course, we all remember now. We make movies about it, and we ensure that it lives on in our cultural memory and identity. But it actually, even Hitler himself stated that part of the reason he felt okay proceeding with the Jewish Holocaust was because nobody remembers the Armenians. And it was literally the reason we coined the word genocide. Because there was not a strong enough word to indicate what happens when you kill 2 million people and attempt to wipe out their entire ethnicity. That hadn't really happened before. And to this day, of course, Turkey and Azerbaijan deny it. And many, many countries haven't acknowledged it. And that, I you know, it's not a stretch to say that 100 years later, because we still haven't acknowledged enormous crimes like that, that countries like Turkey and Azerbaijan still feel quite cocky and confident about attempting similar things today, because they're thinking the same thing Hitler was. Well, who remembers the first time we did it 100 years ago? No one. So why can't we do it again? In the age of social media, can we get away with a genocide? I guess we're about to find out.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. And they certainly have demonstrated to us that the mass media cartel in the West is more than happy to manage narratives and prop up certain countries when they're in a conflict and completely ignore others. We could give as an example what's happening in Yemen. There is arguably an ongoing genocide in Yemen that's happening at the hands of the Saudis. But they are backed by, well, the United States. So that's a little inconvenient of a narrative, but we'll pick up on that after a quick station break here with today's news talk.
You should hear what Omira and Borgeson are talking about.
We're going to talk about President Biden's recent executive order titled Comprehensive Framework for Responsible Development of Digital Assets. To me, that's just a word salad for how best to track your money. Right now, interest rates are rising, the cost of food and rent is skyrocketing, and people are struggling to make ends meet. How will going digital make a difference in your life? And one can't help ask, who benefits? Every day, we see how commercial finance is changing. Phones swiped over keypads for purchases. No need for cash, credit, or debit. Microchips are inserted into hands to allow access to home and work. More importantly, make no mistake, anything digital can be tracked. Every move you make can be tracked. Think about the animal microchips. It's no different with humans. What if you don't want to get chipped and digitized? Will you become a societal pariah? No? Think again. Remember what happened to anyone who refused the COVID jab. They were a danger to society.
Omira and Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Democracy in Action. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back to the Brian McClain Show. I'm joined by the author of Everyone is an Entrepreneur, Mr. Gregory Deal, and he is an American living in Armenia right now. Gregory, you know, we could talk about history and all that stuff for a while, because I think people in the West really, like we're saying, they don't understand it. They don't know it. But I will just tell people to do that research on their own. It's a very interesting turn of events between the 1890s and the 1910s or so, leading up to the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913. But yeah, it did lead to a massive genocide, a massive death march, people being, all of the thought leaders being taken out of the country and moved to other places, you know. So it's estimated that 800,000 to 1.2 million Armenians were sent on death marches to the Syrian desert in 1915 and 1916, driven forward by paramilitary escorts. So yeah, it's a really sad story, you know. Food deprivation, robbery, rape, massacre. I mean, it's really grim history, but we'll leave that for folks to look into on their own. Gregory, so tell us a little bit about your book and maybe your experience that kind of led you to realize that you wanted to write this book and maybe benefit the people where you live there in Armenia.
Yeah, well, actually, I have two books, as you mentioned, that I'd like to talk about, although the second one I am not the author of. I ended up producing it and publishing it through my company and writing the foreword to it. That one is called Sadistic Pleasures, Silent Crimes of Azerbaijan, which was written by a journalist I know named Ashkin Arakelian, who is from the scenic region of Armenia, the one that's currently under attack by Azerbaijan. And what she did was interview 14 different prisoners of war, both military and citizen, who were captured by the Azerbaijani army during the first attack 2 years ago, let alone what's happened since then. And her intention was to bring eyes to international human rights organizations of not just, you know, that Armenia is being attacked by Azerbaijan, but look what they're doing to our citizens. Look what they're doing to our soldiers without a care in the world. Because some of the stories she describes are just horrific and not for the faint-hearted. And so that one, actually, it's interesting, sales have boosted in that one in the last few weeks ever since Azerbaijan started attacking Armenia again. So I guess somehow, you know, the press is getting out and more people want to read more about this. So hopefully that book will continue to play a role in bringing awareness to what's going on. So I suggest if people want to know what's happened with the most recent war starting 2 years ago, go check out Sadistic Pleasures, Silent Crimes of Azerbaijan on Amazon. But my book, which primarily concerns cultural mentalities about freedom, self-direction in life, and entrepreneurship. It's called Everyone is an Entrepreneur, Selling Economic Self-Determination in a Post-Soviet World. And it was inspired primarily by my observations of living here in Armenia for the last 3 years, plus a lot of other world travel and parts of other Eastern European countries, Georgia, Ukraine, and a few other places. It was my attempt to try to understand why, even living among intelligent, skilled, and resourceful people, there seemed to be certain concepts that work basically common sense to most Americans and most Westerners in general, even people who've never had explicit business or economics educations. There are certain things we just grow up knowing and being encouraged to do in the West that for some reason don't really exist here. And I started putting the pieces together. A lot of it had to do with the communist Soviet past in this part of the world, because until just 30 years ago, 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was essentially no reason to be entrepreneurial or be self-directed in life or to have any understanding of economics whatsoever, because your most important decisions in life were determined by the state, by the government that told you what to do and threatened to torture or kill you or cut your bread rations if you didn't listen. So the only thing you needed to know was how to follow orders really well and maybe steal from the bread factory if you had the opportunity to. You know, that's how people survived. But the closest thing they had to entrepreneurs, the true entrepreneurs in the spirit of the word, were people who operated on the black market, like people who were able to get foreign made goods snuck into the country and trade them among each other because there wasn't enough of the locally Soviet produced goods, or an American pair of blue jeans was just always better quality than the Soviet equivalent, right? So everybody knew if it came from the West, it was better quality. And even though our money is worth this, we will barter valuable items if you can get a hold of anything from the West. It became like currency to them, essentially. If you could get rock and roll records, that was as good as money to you. It was better than the Soviet ruble. So those were the real entrepreneurs.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, I would have done it. Man, if that was me, I would have done anything to get my Metallica albums when I was a kid. Amazing. Hold that thought for 1 second there, because that sets up sort of the cultural setup that you were dealing with, that you walked into when you got there, and that you'd noticed in other countries as well. And then it becomes interesting because you start seeing like, oh, maybe just a little information sharing, we can do a little culture jamming here and sort of bridge that cultural gap. There's sort of a normalcy bias, it sounds like, that was going on there when it came to how commerce works and how self-determinism, new opportunities for self-determinism. So we'll pick up right there on the other side of a break. We're going to take some headlines here with today's News Talk.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines.
Authorities in Florida have warned that fatalities will be in the hundreds as Hurricane Ian continues to barrel its way across the state, leaving a trail of complete destruction in its wake. Prime Minister Liz Truss was given examples of the potential hardship facing millions as she embarked on a round of BBC local news interviews, in which she said she would not alter course from plans to massively cut taxes and increase borrowing by billions.
God, you're amazing. You're a much better listener than my wife. You're always there for me. I think I may be in love.
Where is she?
It's not what it seems. I was talking to...
Who's the tramp I heard you talking to?
That was my Alexa, sweetie.
Well, she sounds like a tramp.
Fall in love with news and talk all over again with your smart device. Just tell it to play.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. It's wonderful to have you all listening. Thank you for your time. I'm joined by Gregory Deal. He's an author, and we're talking about his book, Everyone is an Entrepreneur, and how that came about after he spent time living in Armenia, where he currently is. Interesting that you have a house in Ecuador also, Gregory. My next guest coming up is one of my colleagues, and he also is a California refugee who is living in Ecuador. So that's a nice little synchronicity for today. I'll have to connect you guys.
Sure.
Yeah, for sure. So we're talking about sort of that cultural mindset of post-Soviet ruled areas. And, I never really thought about that before. So it's interesting that you bring that up. It's only been 30 years since the Soviet Union collapsed. And there's a lot of holdover sort of ideals going when it comes to how to do things. And really, it seems like the, as you stated, the entrepreneurial minded people were sort of just stuck in the black market, which is probably not necessary right now, seeing as the culture has changed a little bit. So tell us, pick up right there where you left off.
Yeah, so what I've realized is that even though no one under 30 today directly experienced the Soviet Union, they're all, of course, learning the rules of life from their parents and grandparents who did. And so the game changed very rapidly, because before, somebody told you what to do and told you how much money and how much bread you'd be receiving and how many various other material possessions you'd be having as a result of the work that you do. And so you didn't have any incentive for you to figure out what is the most value I can produce for myself through my knowledge and my skills and acquiring my own tools and setting up systems that I can scale to larger and larger degrees. And so, again, those are the kinds of things we really take for granted in the West because they just seem so obvious because we live in a world where we've always been encouraged to figure things out for ourselves and take responsibility for our own lives to a large degree. We can argue, of course, there's plenty of intervention in the West that also interferes with the way we think about those things. But it's a far, far better situation in America than in somewhere like Eastern Europe, where people haven't figured out that they have the capacity, like, to buy their own tools and educate themselves and learn a valuable trade. You know, a lot of them have valuable trades, but they haven't figured out, like, that they can start a business with it and scale up the efficiency with which they perform that trade and therefore make more money and reinvest some of that money into their own business or freelance work or whatever it is. You see what I mean? Like, there are certain basic premises that seem to be missing in their minds. So my book, Everyone is an Entrepreneur, is about trying to examine what these premises are, why they're missing, even though these people should clearly be intelligent enough to understand them, and what could it look like if we could better educate the youth here and even some of the older people who are open-minded, because hope isn't lost forever. I know some older people who have really been influenced by me trying to explain these kinds of things to them here. And what would Armenia look like if every young Armenian had the same entrepreneurial mentality as every young American? And how would their lives be better if they could just see more efficient ways to determine the direction of their own lives and produce more output with their various forms of input, bluntly speaking?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned in the article I was reading, the tools, just the fact that, and you mentioned it just now too, the fact that somebody could invest in tools and build something of their own. I mean, we take that for granted here in the United States because, you know, we've got these giant box stores on, you know, every strip mall has a Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever. And, you know, we go through drills and skill saws and stuff like they're, you know, like they're going out of style here. It's like we've got everything, you know, everything you need to build a house or a building or a business. It's all there in those stores. But, you know, the cultural mindset, that post-Soviet cultural mindset, it sounds like people aren't, in some cases, don't even have that sort of experience, you know, of seeing their dad going down and, you know, going down to the hardware store and buying some supplies for something and then putting it together or repairing something or, you know, just it definitely added a lot of context to me when I read that part and I was like, oh, wow. So, I mean, even concepts like this that we take for granted, a little bit of self-determinism, you know, a little bit of personal work that creates something that can then, enrich you or enrich your society in some way, you know, a business or something like that.
Yeah, they have to see cause and effect. They have to believe that if they take strategic actions now, that the long-term future will be better because of those actions, that every action they take is an investment, not just direct monetary investments. Like if I spend a lot of money on something, I might make more money later. But the time I spend into learning how to do things or making connections with people, that cause and effect relationship was largely absent from the Soviet economy because it was all determined by an overseer, someone in a labor ministry, making these kinds of decisions on behalf of the entire economy, right? And because supposedly central planning works out better than the free market, right, of individuals making these choices for themselves. And so they just don't think that way. They just think, well, here's what I know how to do. I'm just going to keep doing this over and over again because it's enough to feed me until I die. Like the concept of taking strategic risks and thinking outside the box and trying things in a different way is so dampened here. And it's much better in the capital city, Yerevan, certainly, which feels like a very modern city. But even there, you know, you'll see the effects of this. And I show the book to all my young Armenian friends. It's already being translated into Armenian, and it should be available here in the local language, but I already have copies in English here. And almost everyone will agree completely with virtually everything I've written in the book when I'm describing the way they think about things and how it limits them. Like, so they're clearly smart enough to see that this is true when I describe it to them, but they don't have that American spark where they say, hey, I'm going to do something about this. That's really one of the biggest things I miss about America and the American way, is that when an American has an idea that seems like a good idea or something they're ambitious or passionate about, they just do it, you know? And sometimes that doesn't work out in our favor. Sometimes we're too reckless. Sometimes we make mistakes, sure. But the point is that we're willing to try in spite of that. And here, I will never accuse them of being dumb. They're quite intelligent people. but they don't have that little spark that says, hey, I'm going to try that because that's something I want. Even though no one around me is doing it and I might fail, the alternative is unacceptable to me. I have to try, so I'm going to go do that now. That's what Armenia needs.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, arguably without that spark, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you, you know, when I started getting on microphones, I had that same thought process where it's like, well, I want to do this. I'm just going to do it. It may not work out. I'm going to try it. I might fail, but you know what the cool thing about that is, I didn't, and here I am. So there are plenty of examples of when that works, and regarding examples where that doesn't work, oftentimes when one door closes, another one opens, and that whole putting that out there, putting that energy into the world out there, trying to, you know, just do something entrepreneurial or whatever, sometimes it doesn't work out. But generally speaking, more often than not, you're going to find a new path within, you know, once the path you're on doesn't have the outcome or the fulfillment or the heart, if you will, you can find a new one often in that.
Yeah, and even if you fail, you learn something from that. That's the entire point. So that maybe the second or third or tenth attempt, you're trying something new each time and iterating and improving. The Armenian culture mentality just doesn't have the space for that. It just thinks, no, I need to do things that I know will work. And here's what I see everyone else doing. So that's what I'm going to do too. Even if it means I will be condemned to spending my entire life being unfulfilled, making very little wages, but I will at least have some illusion of security and stability in my life. And that's what the majority of them go for, because their parents and grandparents are telling them that's how you have to live your life. There's no other way. Anything else is too dangerous. It's very self-victimizing. I feel so bad for them. And that's part of my inspiration to write this book, both for Westerners to kind of take a look at it and try to understand the things they take for granted about how their own culture has equipped them to take control of their own life. But also I want my Armenian brethren to read this and say, you know, it is time for change. 30 years is long enough. We need to move away from the constraints of our past and accept that there are objective universal principles we can adopt that will vastly improve the quality of our life and our ability to make choices that better ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, that is that's one of the things that gives people spark, you know, what gives them a reason to wake up in the morning, gives them a reason to exist, you know. You mentioned that in you opened your TED speak that I watched with one of the most terrifying things in life is not knowing who you are, what you're here for, or where you're headed, you know. And if you have that entrepreneurial spark, or, you know, whatever, it doesn't have to be a business. You could be, you know, sparked by your skateboarding or your snowboarding or whatever, you know, your guitar playing, and you put everything into those, and eventually a path will present itself to you. In one way, shape, or form, usually, you know, I mean, it doesn't always work out, but there's definitely a path that forms when one has that mindset.
Sure. Do you think I'd be essentially retired at 34 in an Armenian village if I weren't following my own entrepreneurial, creative path through life? This is the result of many iterations of experimenting, living in many different countries, many experiences that have been unpleasant and that I had to learn some very difficult things from, and many experiences that were amazing and life-changing and wonderful. And so it's only because I have such a strong mindset of self-determination, economic or otherwise, that I am here living the life that I do. And there's an opportunity for me to hopefully have some kind of positive influence on a culture that I think could benefit greatly from the kind of values I represent that are very rare here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, like you said, there is a lesson to be taken here for Westerners also. So I'm going to recommend that, you know, all of our Western listeners pick up the book also, because I feel like this is a great example, or in some ways sort of a sad example, of what can happen in the long term when you live under a government that is doing, you know, like you said, central planning instead of free marketplaces. It sets everybody up to never think outside the paradigm, and it can last for generations after it goes away. So, you know, the detriment of socialism, of dictatorships, of, you know, Marxist lifestyles, whatever. This is a great case study for where that all goes, what it can do to the mindset of a culture, and how it can sort of clip the wings of humanity, you know. So I'll take your thoughts on that on the other side of one last station break here. We'll be right back, everybody, with Gregory Diehl on today's News Talk.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Remember how on stage with cameras rolling, Joe Biden bragged how he threatened Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko in March 2016, that the Obama administration would pull $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees and send Ukraine into insolvency if it didn't immediately fire Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin, who was investigating Hunter Biden's crimes in Ukraine? I said, "You're not getting the billion," Biden began. "I'm going to be leaving here in, I think it was about 6 hours." I looked at them and I said, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money." "Well, son of a bitch, he got fired," Biden bragged. Huh. Remember in February of this year at a press conference with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Biden said, "If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine. There will no longer be a Nord Stream 2. Reporter asked, "How do you plan to do that since the project is in Germany's control?" "We will, I promise you, we will be able to do it," Biden said, smirking. "Well, son of a bitch." From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The Anglo-American-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were justified as a war on terror following 9/11. But what if the official 9/11 narrative is a lie, just like Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction or his human shredding machine? There's another side to 9/11 which the mainstream media won't expose. The official 9/11 narrative would have you believe planes crashing into the World Trade Center's Twin Towers led to their collapse. But do you know that World Trade Center Building 7 collapsed on the same day, September 11, 2001? It was a 47-story skyscraper. It collapsed in under 7 seconds at 5:20 p.m., yet no plane crashed into it. A carefully planned, controlled demolition would explain such a collapse, which occurred at close to free-fall speed.
Late this afternoon, just before 5:30 p.m., the number 7 building at the World Trade Center also collapsed.
TNT Radio will cover this story to find the actual perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Gregory Diehl is joining me here on the show on today's News Talk. He's the author of Everyone is an Entrepreneur, a book that examines why entrepreneurship has been so slow to spread in post-Soviet cultures like Armenia. He's also produced a book called Sadistic Pleasures, which is a bit unsettling, it sounds like. But folks, I think you should check it out because these are the kind of stories that you will not ever hear in Western media. Quite literally, you will not hear those kind of firsthand stories that are collected in that book. So Gregory, welcome back. What do you think about that? Like the message to potentially Western readers here, because we have our own normalcy bias. You know, our normalcy bias right now is that we can get a job whenever we want in whatever field we, you know, are qualified for, that we can go to the store and we can purchase, you know, assuming we have the cash for it, we can go to the store, we can purchase whatever it is we want to own, you know, make ours. We can buy land, we can buy property, we can start businesses, all these things. And, you know, many argue that that is all under that's under threat right now. It's under threat of the new normal, the World Economic Forum, the Trilateral Commission, our own politicians pushing towards furthering more Marxist-looking policies. They're talking about central banking, digital currency, taking away our ability to have cash. They're talking about universal basic income. And all these things amount to a technocratic version of that Soviet style, or just that Marxist or communist style. So what do you think about that? What kind of message, you know, might Westerners take from your book?
Well, so, you know, it's like the old parable that a fish doesn't know what water is because it's all they've ever known. They have no perspective otherwise, even though it's all around them. To them, it's just nothing. It's just what is, right? Whereas somebody who's been both on land and underwater will have a much better perspective on both because of the contrast. I think probably the greatest value that my book and my perspective can offer Westerners is that it will give you the perspective of what life is like when the things you overlook and take for granted are almost completely absent. When you try to look at the principles of economics and entrepreneurship through an absolute, universal, total lens, and instead of just where we're used to applying them, where we've been told it's okay and it's normal and encouraged to apply them, one, you start to realize where you could be doing more than you currently are. Like maybe you're not really taking into account the value of the various tangible and intangible assets in your life, your knowledge and your skills, the various material possessions you own. And you start to look more on the societal level too, that in many ways we've never had the level of freedom we just kind of assume that we do, because there are so many aspects of the American economy that are still centrally controlled, but we've just accepted, well, of course they are. That's just the way things are. That's the way they have to be. How else is it going to be? Which is always a very short-sighted false alternative as far as I'm concerned, because it's the same kind of thing that any Soviet citizen would have said about virtually anything their government did. If you tried to ask the average brainwashed Soviet slave, well, why can't we produce our own bread, right? Why do we have to get rations from the state-run factory that tells us exactly how much bread will be produced and how much we're allowed to have? Why, if I know how to make bread and I know how to grow wheat and process it and all these things, why can't, it wouldn't it be good for me and my neighbors to put more bread into an economy full of people who are by and large starving? Right? More bread would be a good thing. Why can't I do that? Well, because the state has to be the one managing it. Who else could possibly manage it? The state is where we get our bread from. If the state weren't handling that, we wouldn't have any bread. That's the only place that bread comes from. You idiot. Obviously, open your eyes, right? But if you went into a modern American supermarket, a Whole Foods or something, you'd be surrounded by countless varieties, not just of bread, but of basically every food imaginable, either locally produced or shipped in from all around the world. More food in total amount and in different varieties than the Soviet citizen could possibly imagine. And there isn't one central agency determining exactly how much should be produced of every little thing and how much every individual person should get. It's all just individuals competing on the market to produce what they consider to be the best possible product for the best possible price. And look at the abundance that's created, right? So if you can understand why that argument that, well, only the state can produce bread because they're the ones who currently produce it and otherwise we'd have no bread, that's obviously a false alternative, because the other unspoken alternative is that, well, individuals, anyone who knows how to make bread could make bread, right? How does that same argument not apply to everything the state does? Everything. I don't care what the topic is, healthcare, education, the roads, anything that we have accepted it's normal that entrepreneurs should not be involved in and must be centrally planned. What's the basis for that argument? Other than, well, that's just the way we do it. And as far as I know, the way we've always done it. So if we didn't do it that way, how would we possibly do it? It can't be done if we don't do it the way we're doing it. Really? You can't. Mm-hmm. You can't open your mind the slightest bit and think that maybe there are other people who, at the very least, should be given the option of providing us an alternative, right? Why? Why can't we open our minds to the total universal application of entrepreneurial and economic principles if we claim that we understand them? That's the mind-opening effect that I hope that this book has. for the individual to understand it. Am I living my life the best way that I possibly can? Am I producing as much of what I value most in my life by understanding the value of my actions applied entrepreneurially? And two, how can our society and our planet as a whole improve if we start implementing these things, even in places where traditionally we haven't thought that entrepreneurship has any place?
Yeah. It's so important, you know, and it provides a giant paradigm shift. And I'm always interested when I see a massive paradigm shift that the public didn't see coming. You know what I mean? Like, we get paradigm shifts that change everything that we have no say in. I'll give you an example. The normalization of smartphones, that changed everything. That changed our mm-hmm. culture. That changed the wiring in our brains. That changed our ability to seek information. And it also hampered our ability to acquire knowledge because of the way propaganda is inserted into these things. It has changed the way children develop. It has changed sexuality in our culture. It has changed morality in our culture. And of course, you know, that has to work in tandem with the education system changes and, you know, entertainment system changes and things like that. But the fact that we put that thing in so many people's hands, basically the whole world's hands, within, you know, 10, 15 years, completely changed our paradigm in some ways, in you know, amazing ways, but in other ways, ways that have arguably degraded our culture and degraded our potential. And no one talked to us about that. No one asked us about that. No one said, you know, in 2003, hey, we're gonna make it so that everybody has one of these pocket computers, and we're gonna put these social media feedback loops on there that will sort of drive your worldview. How's that sound, everybody? Like, I didn't get that memo. Did you?
No. Well, actually, it's funny. An anecdote I've shared a lot, and I think I talk about it in the book too. Is smartphones aren't just a Western thing. They're everywhere, even in impoverished right. countries. I knew people in Ghana who didn't have indoor plumbing, but all the kids had smartphones. How did that happen? Who exactly. told them that That's this is such an about. Important priority that all your kids need to have smartphones and need to know how to use the internet, but you still have to carry buckets of water into your house every day to bathe?
Right. Never mind clean water. We need to make sure that your daughters understand what twerking is and how to do it.
Right. So it's just astounding. Like, things that you would consider impossible, either technologically or socially or economically or whatever, once an idea takes root, it can just spread because everybody's just acting in what they perceive to be their own best interest, right? If enough people want something, they just make it happen.
Right. Exactly. And it's just a small paradigm shift. And what you're talking about is a paradigm shift that in this example, the people of rural Armenia can create their own paradigm shift. They can ask those questions of themselves and their neighbors and their community members. Hey, what about this? What about this paradigm shift that you and I can set up for ourselves that will make us better? And how does that compare to these other paradigm shifts like CBDC and track and trace and all this other technocratic garbage that they want to insert into our new paradigm, which, by the way, folks, takes us away from this entrepreneurial spirit that Gregory is talking about. Gregory, we only got a couple minutes left, so I'll give it to you to you have the floor. Make sure everybody knows where to find you, what your books are called, and all that good stuff. And I will look forward to picking up this conversation. We should do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is just my name, gregorydehl.net. Deal is spelled D-I-E-H-L. The book I mentioned today is called Everyone is an Entrepreneur, Selling Economic Self-Determination in a Post-Soviet World. And the other one I produced about the the Armenian prisoners of war in Azerbaijan was Sadistic Pleasures, Silent Crimes of Azerbaijan. Both of those are on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever. And I have a few other books too on travel and business and personal development if you just want to look me up on Amazon.
All right. Excellent. Well, that is a wealth of knowledge. So everybody be sure and get out there and support Gregory in his efforts because, you know, it's going to benefit everybody. It's going to benefit absolutely everybody. We need to create our own new paradigms. If we don't, the state will do it for us. These ghouls will do it for us. And who/what is the state? Well, it's a global cabal of technocrat wannabes and friends of Jeffrey Epstein, which is disgusting. So we let them drop new normal on us. We let them drop sustainable development on us. We let them drop smartphones equipped with social media feedback loops on us. We let them lock us down for a flu. We let them use 24/7 mass media to propagandize us. We let them tell us our voting system is broken, but we have to keep using it. No, we will not let them complete this next paradigm shift of CBDC and all this ghoulish stuff. So let's stay inspired. Let's stay inspired. And one way you can do that is by picking up Gregory's book. Thank you, Gregory. We'll catch you again next time. And we're going to go to top of the hour news. We'll be back.